So what I want to do today is give a kind of a basic kind of presentation of a theory of human rights, one theory of human rights among many, that derives principally from Aquinas and Thomas Aquinas and from Aristotle, and that has a lot of traction in the mainstream Western tradition from the 16th century up into the 20th century, very prominent in Catholic ethics, but not really per se a religious conception. What I mean by that is, you may think because I'm a Catholic priest and because I'm wearing a habit that I'll tell you that the basis for human rights is belief in God or transcendent standards of morality, and well, I do believe in God, but actually I'm going to root it in something that doesn't, you might say, abstract from the question of God. It can lead to that question, but actually it's just a basic conception of human rights that's, I think, universally available. It's rather commonsensical, and is based in a kind of fundamental theory of what a human being is. So, you know, there are different concepts of human rights. You have people who are kind of contractualist utilitarians who basically think that human beings are inherently selfish and we need a certain set of protections in place so that we can protect us from one another. You have other people who have a very strong sense of Kantian rights. It's based on autonomy of freedom. So it's all based on the freedom of the rights of the individual, in view of their own autonomous self-realization. But Aristotle, and specifically Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, 13th century Dominican, you know, very important philosopher and theologian in the Western tradition, they argue that rights are based on natural inclinations. Based on natural inclinations, that's to say, orientations of our nature towards what constitutes human flourishing. So there's certain things that make human beings flourish. We might give a kind of example of friendship. And you can derive from those the theory of rights, of the kinds of things that we need to be able to do to be the kinds of things we are. So you might say it's a realist concept of rights. It's based in what human beings really are. That's the idea. St. Thomas talks about this conception of rights in the Summa Theologiae, his famous, you know, theological book, the first part of the second part, question 94, article 2. It's a famous article. It's a famous place. He gives a conception of five basic inclinations that are in human beings. And he puts them according to three groupings. One grouping is what we have in common with all things, all insofar as we exist, and all living things, because we're living beings. Another kind of grouping is insofar as we're animals. And then two other of his five basic inclinations come from insofar as we're rational animals. So just a couple of caveats. When I'm going to talk about the five inclinations, and I'm going to talk about some rights that devolve from them. We're not talking about the sort of random desires of a given individual. So, I mean, one standard objection would be, you're about to talk to me about natural inclinations and human beings. That means that it has something to do with human beings' natural desires. It's not quite the same thing as natural desires. It's deeper than a desire, but it can be manifest in desire. So everything a human being ever desires must somehow be a natural inclination. There must be a natural right. So you can take, you know, very gruesome examples like, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer or someone who has a kind of proclivity towards extremely crazy behavior and say that's a natural inclination. But no. So what I'm about to talk about is not the inclinations or the desires of a given individual, but something that we can identify, Aquinas thinks, as universal inclinations. The second thing is, it's not based on an immediately religious foundation, as if we were to say, it must be the case that God upholds us with these natural inclinations. It's rather that there are inclinations in us that may suggest the existence of God. And here's the last point, it's a really important point. A lot of modern theories of conceptions of rights are either based on a kind of very angelic conception of human free will, based on human autonomy, that comes from Immanuel Kant. It's like, my freedom of decision-making is the preeminent thing about my rights. Or they're based on a very materialistic conception, like you get like Peter Singer at Princeton, who's materialist and utilitarian, and basically it's like the arrangement of my pleasures and pains. What's great about Aquinas is it's both the animality of the human being that gives us our inclinations and rights, and our rationality. So it's not an either-or. Like, so you have a patient who's unconscious. Do they have rights? Well, yeah, they've got lots of rights. Or you've got a person who is, you've got lots of rights even when they're not capable of exercising their autonomy because of the kind of being they are. But But then you say, you could take another case where you say, well, okay, I don't believe there is something, I think freedom is illusory, you know. Aquinas is going to say that you have to take some rational features of human behavior seriously to understand what rights are. We're not, to be a veterinarian is very different than to be a doctor. And I'm not saying that animals don't need to be accorded dignity also, but it's a different consideration. You need to take it seriously with the physicality and the living animality of a human being as part of their rights, and you need to take seriously their freedom and their reason as part of their rights. So there's a holism to Aquinas. It's nice. Okay, so here we go. What do we have in common with all beings? Well, we have an inclination to exist. Now, you know, what he's talking about is kind of like unity in a being over time that endures. Now, in our case, our corporeal unity as a coherent being, it exists insofar as we're alive. And so we have in common with all living things the inclination to life, which includes the inclination to growth, to self-defense or protection from harm, and to healing when we are injured. And those are all things that are instantiated in us just insofar as we're living things. Right? What we have in common with other animals is the natural inclination to sexual intercourse in view of procreation and the education of children. That's Aquinas' way of thinking about it. What he means is human beings have a natural inclination to tend to couple and to form families and to raise families and to acquire special relationships with their children and to want to educate them, to protect them, and to see them become autonomous adults, what we see often in nature. It's a really very basic claim. And then he says what we have in virtue of our rational nature is the inclination to political life and society, relationships of justice, and friendship. So, for example, Aquinas will say you have a basic right to be treated affably, which he says is an affability, friendliness, he says is a dimension of the virtue of justice. Because every human being has a kind of political dignity as a subject in the community and should be treated or afforded friendliness. It's different than friendship. You don't have a right to someone's friendship. Friendship is a gift. But affability, friendliness, is a sort of form of justice. So, and he says it's the form of justice that is the closest to friendship and permits the basis for friendship. And all the other virtues for Aquinas are kind of related to friendliness and friendship, because you want to be just in order to be interpersonal. You want to be temperate. You want to be temperate. You want to show some fortitude in order to have just relations with other people. Society, cardinal virtues are related to friendship and justice. And lastly, there's an inclination to want to know the truth. No one likes to be lied to. We actually have an instinctive awareness that there's something going wrong. It's kind of unjust when people lie to us. Everybody kind of wants to figure out what is real, get it right, have the story straight, do well on the exam. There's a desire to be in the truth rather than in falsehood. And then he talks about outflowing from that the natural inclination to knowledge of God. Aquinas is a philosopher. He thinks there is an inclination to a way we could talk about that more generally, if we're agnostic or atheistic, is we have a general inclination to want to know what it's all about, the ultimate causes of things. So we do want to know about a lot of little things, like where can I get the espresso, how do I get to the class on time, how am I getting the paycheck, what's the right thing to do in this situation, how can I reconcile with this alienated friend. But all behind it all, we can also ask big questions about like the structure of reality and what's ultimately real. And people have lots, of course, of different opinions about that. But he thinks it's part of the natural inclination to want to figure those things out. So, like, the inclination to be able to search the truth. Now, he thinks from these inclinations, you can start to devise a theory of basic goods. Like, there's just things that all of us need, like the protection of our human life, the right to a relative right to private property. And we could talk about that sort of relative, it's not absolute. The right to have family relations that we sustain. You know, you can have the right to marital fidelity based on someone's promises to you. The right to the truth and the right to freedom of religion. And then he thinks you can then get into subtle cases, like where, you know, people can argue about what's the right thing to do in this or that particular case. And that's where you get the professional ethicists come in. And we ourselves also argue about those things. And so my point is that these fundamental principles allow shared consensus And then from that shared consensus, you can get into technical questions where we can differ, but sometimes it's good to just try to think about what the fundamental basics are we can agree on. So he's going to get a pretty ambitious sort of social doctrine out of this about the right to exist, the basic right to life, the right to shelter, the right to nutrition, you know, the right to clean drinking water, the right to preservation from harm, the public good, you know, why do we have security in our culture, you know, police, it should be to keep us from personal harm and to protect the vulnerable, the pursuit of health, right, the right to pursue one's own, to seek out one's own health and to safeguard one's health, the right to adequate health care, the right for the family to exist, the right to marry freely and not to be compelled in marriage. That may sound anachronistic to you, but that's actually, of course, historically quite an important question, whether you can be compelled to marry. The right to found a family, the right to have children with another person, the right to educate one's children. The right to education, that's a very fundamental teaching in Catholic social doctrine based on this idea. Every human being has a right to an adequate education so that they can participate in the common good, so that they can know enough truth that they can contribute to society. There's a right to non-exploitative work, because work is a constitutive element of living in political life with other people. So if people are unemployed, if they can't get access to work, they have a right to work, and we have an obligation and in the public common good to try to create venues for them to acquire work. They also have responsibility to work, of course, but they need also to have venues in which they can acquire work. There's a right to free assembly, because those are places we try to find the truth together or enjoy social life together. So when totalitarian regimes crush the right to public assembly or try to eliminate free communication of ideas, that can be a problem. It's contrary to our rights of free assembly and participation, public participation in the pursuit of the truth, and the rights of religious organizations to assemble and to serve the common good. And, of course, the right to orient oneself towards ultimate truths about reality. If you don't have these things, what you're doing, in fact, is harming the capacities of people to realize their own flourishing. Right? And we can see it. It's very concrete. A person who doesn't have a venue for how to get work in our society has some, like, the dimension of their human flourishing is frustrated, and we need to find venues for them to be able to live out their capacities. If you take away from someone the right to free expression of their beliefs or their truths in public debate, you harm some deep dimension of the human being. Right? So natural inclinations that we instinctively kind of know that we have or that we can ascertain are the basis for these capacities, the capacity to seek the truth, the capacity to live in community, the capacity for justice. And the capacities are things that we need to safeguard and uphold by a sort of system of rights. How would this, I'll just finish you with this and I'll take Q&A. How would this pertain to medical care? Well, for Aquinas, the basic inclinations would also give you a bunch of rights that would be, this is not an exhaustive list, but that would be telling for medical care personnel. There's obviously the right to life. In some real sense, that's what we're all united by in medical care, is that we're trying to uphold and safeguard human life and help people flourish. And for Aquinas, that would be from conception to natural death, insofar as he thinks the human being acquires status as a person from the first beginnings. And so that would exclude abortion and euthanasia. There'd be a right, I mean, it's obviously a highly disputed point, but you can see the conception there is one of that once you have a human life, there's a fundamental kind of inclination to life that needs to be protected and safeguarded. The right to basic medical care independently of wealth or status, because once you have a human being that has animal proclivities to want to be healthy, then the human society has an obligation to it. So if you're working in Georgetown Hospital in Washington, D.C., in the emergency room where I had the unhappy experience of visiting this summer, and they bring in a loud and homeless person who's extremely obnoxious who came in 3 times this last week, they get medical care. In fact, he went way before me because he was making so much noise. And I have to say, I greatly admired him as I sat there for 2 hours quietly. But he was obstreperous. But he also has rights. You know, he cannot be discarded. He is inconvenient, but he is a human being, and he has rights to be treated for health, even though it's just basically on the common public wheel. You have the right to procreate and have children. You know, I think from the Thomist point of view, you know, forced sterilization would be wrong. The right of the family members to be with their loved ones who are sick or dying, and their right to be involved with their care. That's obviously a place where I've worked as a hospital chaplain at Sloan Kettering. My dad's a doctor as well. And that's a place where there can be immense tensions, because often the doctor has a lot more expertise, of course, than the family, but then the family really wants to be involved in the decision-making process. That can be burdensome, especially to doctors who are really harassed and busy and have a lot of places to be and things to go, places to go. But it is actually part of the structure of reality. You know, it's just really, I say as a priest, it's extremely important to help the family understand and to integrate them. And if they make a decision you don't fully agree with, you know, at times that really is just important to respect. There's times when they might not be making the right decision, and it's important to try to dissuade them. The right to the truth in medical situations, and I'll say this too, I mean, it's not like I think you should be brutal about it, but I worked in, you know, care of terminal patients and cancer, and it's weird to have the doctors tell the patient over and over again that they're going to do everything, they're doing everything they can to make them better, like 2 days before they die, and, you know, the doctor leaves the room, and they look at me and say, well, it's funny how you can't just tell me I'm dying, you know. Now, I'm not saying you should leave to tell people they're dying prematurely, but, I mean, you know, having a compassionate way of telling people the truth is important. And there's, of course, rights to truth in the medical community. I mean, you have the right to have truths heard that you have to say. I mean, medicine is, as we know, a very complicated political world, and there needs to be the right to express the truth in difficult situations within the political life of the hospital or the medical care community. And so people have a right to a non-exploitative, just working environment among medical workers, a right to fair practices in medical trade, and freedom of religion of both patients and medical personnel. And as we know, you know, medical personnel need to respect the rights of patients to be cared for religiously, and also medical personnel need to respect each other's religious or non-religious proclivities and have deep respect for each other in friendliness and justice and fairness independently of people's religious beliefs, and perhaps in you know, some degree of shared engagement. All right, so I kept that to like 25 minutes, which I obey. There are no bad questions or objections, and I'm happy to take questions now. And I know that people will need to leave, so if you need to get up and go, that's fine. Yes, ma'am.
So you're describing all these rights that are supposedly working towards this end goal of, like, human flourishing.
Yeah.
One, what is human flourishing?
Yeah.
And two, kind of, why is that end goal?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's an ideology. I think when you look at human beings living out their lives, that's a concept from Aristotle, human flourishing. And he takes it as a kind of given. That, like, just like you would see, analogously to the fact that you see a plant grow and put out flowers and put out seedlings and then create another like kind of plant, or you'd see animals have certain kind of ways that they develop and perfect biologically as animals. So human animals have certain kinds of ways that they tend to mature and flourish as animals that are rational. And so we have all kinds of special considerations about what it means for us as animals to do well as persons. So then you get into kind of like trying to figure out the taxonomies, that what are the ways we flourish? Well, one of them for Aristotle is ethical. Like, so through friendship, through life in political society with others, and through a shared life of, well, often through family life. He thinks people often find flourishing through their life with their families. Through art, through work and art, there's a certain perfecting of the human person. So people acquire a kind of flourishing of a sense of their value and of their contribution to life through work and through art. Also through the speculative life of the mind, just like trying to find the truth and trying to understand reality. Aristotle thinks that we enjoy trying to understand for its own sake. And that's part of the dignity of what it is to be a human person, so we can find the truth, try to understand the truth, interpret reality. Aquinas would add religion to that and say that religious, the truth opens us up to religious behavior. And so there's a certain kind of set of diverse goods that can then be elaborated to help us become fully human. And if we don't want to acknowledge some part of that list, what we're going to end up with is a reduced concept of a human being. Like if we say, well, no, art is not part of, you know, the Spartan conception. Art is not part of human existence. Work is not part of human existence. It's not enough. But if you can also make the other mistake of saying just one of those things is everything. You know, so that, I mean, that's where your question is excellent. It leads into a larger philosophy of what a human being is, what constitutes human flourishing, and then how that helps us enrich a conception of rights. You're unsatisfied. You think it's too arbitrary.
I just don't know why, but why are we, like, I can see where all these things that we're doing can lead to this, I don't know, arbitrary experience of satisfaction and growth and progression or whatever, but why is that the basis of, like, having these rights, or, like, why do we need to aim for this, like, idea of, like, human perfection or something?
Well, there's kinds of human perfection I wouldn't want to aim for. I think, you know, where we'd have to do, what we'd have to do is get into a kind of a Aristotelian dialectic or a discussion where we'd have to figure out what other theories we could, you know, consider. Could we consider that basically everything is a cultural construct, human beings don't actually really, they just basically have subjective experiences of privileging a set of choices they make over another set, and so it's really kind of arbitrary constructions. Kantian constructivism or Nietzschean constructivism. So basically everything is a kind of a personal subjective construal of reality. And then we have to look at, you know, I could try to argue with you about whether that's the way you really live your life, or do you know anyone who really lives their life only through uniquely individuated subjective preferences, or whether in fact they also all meet sort of standards of universality with regards to some of these inclinations. You know, so my Nietzschean friends from Brown, when they got sick, still went to the doctor. They didn't culturally construct the illness as something that was, you know, in this case, arbitrarily to be construed as, something contrary to the positive characteristics of health as described by modern biology. So I would try to use that as evidence against them in their theoretics. You know, so I would, in a dialectical situation, I'd try to push back and say, yeah, I mean, clearly we have a lot of, we can err. I mean, we can err, or we can have very different construals of preferences, of what causes us to feel satisfaction or perfection. But I think this list is very modest, and actually, I would argue, works itself out in some way in every culture over and above even some of the really important distinctions. You know, like, I would argue that Mao's China, I've been teaching a little bit in China recently, so I've been thinking about this with young philosophy students in China. I would argue in Mao's atheist China and communist China, these five inclinations still show up. You know, so that's, I think, the advantage of is the universality. But I'd be interested in defending that in a debate.
I think Jean-Paul Sartre probably did go to a surgeon who thought that kidneys should be hooked up to the brain.
Yeah, no, that's right. So, but Sartre, it is interesting that Sartre does argue that you can, to show your freedom to construct meaning in life, you can kill yourself to show your mastery over what other people consider native instincts. And he had disciples who did commit suicide, not really particularly out of depression, but simply because of clinical depression, but as it were, French philosophical decision-making led them to commit suicide. And I would say that's like what I'm saying are acts of a man rather than basic natural inclinations. I think most, you know, I mean, that's a famous debate, whether those counterexamples show that people don't have a natural inclination toward life because people want to take their own lives in certain cases. But I think in those cases, even of like the high French decision of freedom to, you know, show my freedom over life by suicide, I think we can still show that there are, most people have the right reaction to that, to think that that's something violent in a human person. And also, it's actually interesting that it does show the inclination of human reason to want to be free from constraints, but I think it's misconstruing the way of doing that. So, I mean, this is where we do get into interesting cases, the subtle cases of ethics. They're fun and difficult. Yes, ma'am.
Father, I was wondering, I think I definitely agree with you that instincts are so seen very common to human experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't call them instincts, just by the way, because instinct is like a psychological thing that's manifested. As these are deeper, like inclinations of being. I mean, this is a, when I'm not conscious, I still have these. These things, they characterize our very way. And notice, you don't have to give an immaterial theory of reason for this to be true. I mean, I believe in the immateriality of aspects of human cognition and freedom. And I do believe in an immaterial soul. But that's actually a secondary, I mean, that's a secondary consideration, because plenty of people who don't or are unsure of that theory or that idea still believe in human rationality and some kind of respect of human freedom. So that he doesn't really require much of you. Look, I think that part of the crisis of ethics in our own era, I really agree deeply with the ethical theorist Alistair MacIntyre on this issue, that one of the problems is we don't even agree about how to disagree. And that's the deeper issue, is that we can't get straight enough of a theory about what ethics is about to have constructive disagreements. So what we have are like these ersatz intuitions. We're like, well, I'm for this, and I'm against that. Let's fight about it. Okay, I hate you. I hate you too. And it becomes extremely personal, but it doesn't actually become personable or humane or rational. And I think part of the issue is that we don't have a deeper theory about things that we can all agree on. And part of that is, as he points out, because we're fragmented on the very deep level between, say, Kantian theorists of autonomy, Rawls is a kind of Kantian derivative. It's all really about freedom. And then, you know, value constructivism, which is, I think, the default setting of the elite institutions today, versus this more classical theory, which is, by the way, making some reemergence in among non-Catholics neo-Aristotelianism and utilitarians, who people like me tend to consider savages, intellectually, not as human beings. But just like, you know, I just think it's very strange to calculate moral decision making based on pleasure and pain subjectively, and then how we all can regulate our desire preferences for pleasure and pain in ways that don't do harm to one another. It seems to be way too minimal theory. But those are the kinds of deep debates that are happening. And I think what I like about this theory is that it takes the rationality seriously, so you can talk with the Kantian autonomists. It takes the animality seriously, so you can talk with the utilitarians. It doesn't actually require a lot of deep theories about what a human being is, but it, as her question indicated, it opens up to those deeper theories about, like, normative understanding what a human nature is. It accommodates a lot of, like, the things we're already doing. It seems to be good philosophy has to give an account of reality based on, like, what we actually really do in society. We really do pursue a lot of these kind of basic common goods, protect these common rights, and have a theory of justice and punishment based on these normal proclivities of human nature. So, to me, part of the challenge is to try to find forms of speaking and talking about human rights that gives us some discourse for consensus. Even then, we can get into, you know, whether we should raise the minimum wage, or is the minimum wage getting more people in the market as it is? Should we raise it to get more people a living wage? You know, really important questions, but they're derivative from this more fundamental argument. Yes, sir?
How do you balance personal rights and communal rights? So say you're in a society that does sacrifice of individuals for...
human sacrifice?
Yeah, so you can say that this is communally promotes the flourishing of the community as opposed to the obvious individual.
Okay, so I will bite the bullet and say I do think that all individual rights have to be in some way, I mean, I believe in certain rights of privacy, but I think that all individual rights need to be correlated with public, the common good, because I don't think the common good is something outside of me. We depend on other people for our happiness and through our family life, through life in society with friends that we live with. Like, this whole place, the medical school, is a common good. There's like a lot of incredible knowledge being distributed by professors. Well, so like they have rights as individual professors, but they have rights so that the common good can flourish, right? So if there's something going on in the common good that's structurally, gravely contrary to human dignity, as I would say, you know, but which, by the way, you know, human sacrifice is not rare in human history, and not, like, I mean, in a lot of different places we tend to associate it with South America, but it was very common in ancient China, in the near Middle East, in the 3,000 years ago. Hawaii actually had a lot of human sacrifice when the English arrived there. So that's very interesting that like stuff like that has been, you know, things that are very strange can happen in human society. But take a more, I think, a more evident case of like structural forms of racism, right? What we need to argue is not that those things are somehow part of the structure of the common good that need to be respected, but they're placed, they're ways that we're impeding the flourishing of the common good. They're not inclusive enough of the good of individuals, therefore they also harm and wound deeply the common good of society. So I would want to put the fate of these two things together without identifying them, right? I'm not trying to say sacrifice individuals for the common good. I think human beings flourish in community, and so individual rights are, they have to always be located within and be respected by and situated in relation to the rights of the community. Yeah.
I'm kind of like seeing this notion of grounding what we classify as rights based on our enforcement, but like I wonder if some of these bullet points that are rights,
yeah,
like they might on paper sound like they add to our flourishing in society,
yeah,
like when it comes to their manifestation, like maybe like for example the right to procreate and have children. We're living in a world that's like
overpopulated.
Quickly overpopulated. Yeah. Why is that? I understand that how that could be my personal right, but why does that lead to?
Well, that's a good segue. Yeah, that's a good segue. I think the common good does have both, does have rights in this regard as well as the individuals. And so then the question, I mean, that's a very hard question, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, about how do you correlate the individual right to procreate with the right of the common good to try to have a reasonable distribution of goods, a reasonable number of people in reasonable circumstances. So, I mean, as you, I'm sure, know, what they've done in China is have, first the one-child policy, the two-child policy, and they have, they do have a lot of coerced abortion. There's 20 million abortions a year. A high, high percentage of those are coerced. They don't have a very developed contraceptive system, but also they're basically sterilizing people. And there's a lot of involuntary sterilization happening. I think most people would say, in fact, I think a lot of Chinese would say that this is a terribly regrettable situation and that it would be good if they could harmonize better the rights of the individuals with the concerns for the common good. And so I don't think that that's the way we want to go. But if we don't want to go that way, and we don't want to create a totalitarian society where we're sterilizing people against their will or forcing them into medical procedures they absolutely abhor or don't wish to have, then what ought we to do? And I think then we can think about, reasonable incentives, education, trying to talk to people about ways that we can acquire one of the right means to have a reasonable number of persons, et cetera, et cetera.
But I guess like my kind of difficulty with this notion is that like because human flourishing is a dynamic thing that changes throughout society,
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's always that's set in stone. Clearly, for example,
okay, so that's
so therefore
great.
Our rights
yeah.
are always changing too. So should we define our rights based on human flourishing, which can be dynamic as we evolve as human beings?
Okay, so now you've posited a great metaphysical, question. You posited a metaphysical principle, which leads to a great conversation, which is there something stable like human nature through time? To what extent is human nature dynamic? If it's dynamic, is it dynamic in such a way that its essence changes? If its essence doesn't change, are there just facets of it that change? Are we still evolving in some way? Does culture evolve and change in such a way that we actually change what we're capable of, what makes us flourish? And do we become more enlightened over time, or less enlightened over time, about what really constitutes our good? Okay. Absolutely fair questions, essential questions to ethics. But they're not, I would just warn you that I don't think those things could be readily resolved by just first gut instinct. First gut instinct matters, because first gut instinct is telling what I kind of intuit of things true. But those are really hard metaphysical questions. I have opinions about all those things. I rattled them off because I have opinions about all of them. And I do think, culture does evolve ethically greatly over time. I also think it devolves. It's got to devolve, because you've seen so many examples of moral horror in the human race that are new as well as old. And, let's be honest, new medical knowledge can, and scientific knowledge can create new dangers. To name one, atomic bombs, nuclear energy can be very dangerous to human health. Right. So new knowledge is not always a sign of progress. And you always have the question of to what extent are conventions blinding us, or to what extent are conventions malleable, and to what extent are they arbitrary? And so then we can get into things like, you know, sexuality, and sexuality basically being redefined as we enter a new age of less taboo and more, you know, contraception. Does that change us? Or does the sexual revolution not actually redefine us radically? Are there some very fundamental fixtures of human sexuality that remain the same? Is it some mixture of the two? Right? So that's where you do get into hard cases. But I'd still argue that we'll see people couple and form families and have families, and that we're going to still need to have some way to respect the fundamental cell of society. And I would even say it's the monogamous family. Because I think the monogamous heterosexual family seems to be where most children come from. I don't say that as a cleric or as a person with a heavy agenda. I say that just like sociopolitically, it seems to me that that's where most children are coming from. And so we're going to, and where most children be raised. And they tend to do better when they have two parents, it seems. That's disputed, but most sociologists agree it's disputed, okay? So those kinds of questions, I think, the point is, I think, you know, as medical personnel, you're going to continue to have your whole life, you're dealing with families with their children or children with their elderly parents. And those special relationships, I do think, are part of our human flourishing. I don't think that we're going to see, I don't think we're going to enter a new age, a Nietzschean age, in which people are going to say, you know, my relationship with my mother and father is really completely as unimportant to me. It's like less important than my relationship with my employer. Yes, people get alienated from their parents. But I think our relationships with our family members will retain some important concrete exercise for us. And it's going to continue to be important to the medical community. But you'd have to just take them one by one and go through. You're asking a question I think is absolutely vital.
So if you have like a Plato's Republic situation where you have families that are like created or breaking borders, their families created, and that are not important, you basically have people procreating them.
Okay, so that's a great question. You know, he's referring to the Republic where you have like the gold members of society who can take the children away and educate them, take them away from mere mortal families. They don't know what they're doing, right? So can you take a people's child? So this is a very important thing in Aristotle against Plato. Aristotle writes in the Politics that Plato is wrong, that is a totalitarian impulse, and that the family is the basic cell of society, is the condition sine qua non for its existence. And there is a natural right to the education of one's children. This goes forward all the way through the Middle Ages. The famous question Aquinas asks is, can in a Catholic society in the High Middle Ages, can you take the Jewish children away from the parents in order to forcibly baptize them and educate them? And the standard teaching in all of the Middle Ages is absolutely not, because it does violence to the integrity of the family, even though one believes that they're in religious error. But that goes very far for a medieval Aristotelian, because the Jewish family has Jewish schools and Jewish institutions. Now, we can argue about the Jewish ghetto and whether they were, you know, what are the better and worse models of toleration and allowing flourishing of the Jewish community in the Middle Ages. But the point was they recognized their right to live out these natural proclivities even though they had very differing religious estimations. You know, so the church historically is anti-Platonic on that point, radically. And I think it contains still an importance. Because why am I getting feisty? Because of the principles, it's called the principle of subsidiarity. The bigger totalitarian group cannot crush the little group. And it's very important to me in a Hobbesian world, because in Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, he basically argues we're all individual atoms, you know, atomic individuals, and so what we really need is the Leviathan, who's the king, but you could just say the totalitarian despot, who then comes in and imposes his order on everyone, and all the intermediary institutions are crushed. This happens all the time. I mean, it doesn't happen typically in a Western democracy. It's very prevalent in the world. Look at what's happening in Turkey right now. This is exactly what he's doing. And so the principle of subsidiarity is very important to maintain the rights of lesser institutions to, you know, by the way, he's doing it to the universities. you know, he's just expert, you know, expunging the academic, the rights of academics in universities. And so I think, you know, you got to be very careful about subsidiarity rights, because they may start coming after the family first, but come after the university next. Because totalitarianism is an attempt to impose a kind of uniform order over everyone. And I think we'd be very careful about that. That's why like the natural proclivities thing is a kind of a protection of some goods that are intermediary goods, collective common, not just the highest common good of the whole civilization, but collective common goods, like my bowling team. I don't want somebody telling me I can't go bowling for I don't know what reason. I mean, just a stupid example. But the point is we should be able to do like simple things of association like that are frivolous because of the playfulness of it, like the fun of it. Anyway, I'll liberate you. If anybody wants to stay and talk a little bit more, I'm around, okay? Thank you very much. It's great to be here today.